It's Thursday, July 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, families and colleagues say goodbye to slain police officers in Dallas. China continues to denounce South China Sea ruling.
I will miss the roar of the crowd. I will miss the barbs from the opposition.
Britain has a new prime minister. Also ahead, photos from Jupiter and on to strange new worlds at the movies. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Funerals for three of the five police officers killed in last week's sniper attack in Dallas, Texas, are being held, with hundreds of law enforcement officials paying their last respects to their fallen comrades. At the first of the funerals, there was a montage of photos depicting the life of 43-year-old Brent Thompson, an officer for the Dallas Rapid Transit System at a Dallas megachurch. Funerals were set later for two city policemen, Lauren Ahrens and Michael Smith, both among the five gunned down last Thursday by a Black Army veteran who targeted white policemen in revenge for a point-blank police shootings of two African-American men in other parts of the country earlier last week. Funeral services for the other two Dallas officers, Michael Kroll and Patrick Zamaripa, are set for later in the week. VOA spoke with Carlos Zamaripa, who describes his slain older brother as a hero in the purest sense.
My brother was a hero, a true hero. Not one of the ones that asked for the recognition and never asked for the spotlight, never asked for the pat on the shoulder. He was just a true hero, always the person to give out of his heart. And they recognized that. They said that he was a true hero.
Carlos Zamaripa says his brother Patrick always knew he wanted to serve as a police officer.
He always dreamed of being a cop since he was a kid. Since we were kids, we always used to play. And he always used to say, I want to be a cop. I want to be a policeman. And he did that. As we got older, he got out of high school. My sister helped him through that process by first letting him join the military.
The funerals were being held a day after President Barack Obama commemorated the lives at a memorial gathering in Dallas that was also attended by his predecessor, President George W. Bush. President Obama is now back at the White House here in Washington, where he is convening a meeting with law enforcement officials, civil rights leaders, activists, and political leaders to discuss ways to restore trust in communities where there are tensions between police and the residents that they are sworn to protect. Meanwhile, many African-American residents in Ferguson, Missouri, are still struggling to find ways to trust the police 2 years after the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown by a white police officer, Darren Wilson, and the riots that followed. The shooting in Ferguson galvanized support for the national Black Lives Matter movement and a nationwide debate over police brutality and criminal justice reforms. It also exposed years of police misconduct. According to a March 2015 Justice Department study, blacks comprised 67% of Ferguson's population, but accounted for 93% of arrests between the years 2012 and 2014. You'll find much more in terms of details at our website at voanews.com. It's time for us now to check out what the online community is saying about the interaction between GOP presidential hopeful Donald Trump and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Wow, this is an interesting twist. Mm-hmm. International Edition social media guru G. Abby Lee is right here in the studio with details. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has a nickname Notorious RBG, had an interview with CNN, and during that interview, she called Trump a faker. She also elaborated, he has no consistency about him. He says whatever comes to his head at the moment. He really has an ego. Jim, on a scale of 1 to 10, how offensive would you say is the word faker?
Well, it depends what he's faking at the presidential level. True. Potentially, it could be big. Mm-hmm. I think we also need to explain the cultural reference of her nickname.
Right. I knew it comes from the rapper Notorious B.I.G., but didn't really know he's widely known as one of the biggest rappers of all time. So judging by the nickname, you can assume Ginsburg has a reputation for speaking up her mind in and outside of the Supreme Court.
And she has for many years there. I saw Trump reacted quite swiftly to this. Tell us about that.
Sure. He actually demanded Ginsburg to resign. This is what he tweeted. Justice Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court has embarrassed all by making very dumb political statements about me. Her mind is shot. Resign. To that, the most liked reply was reminding him that he's the one who couldn't remember white supremacist group KKK's former leader, David Duke, during an interview. What's really interesting here is that the New York Times shared a more or less similar opinion of Ginsburg's interview with CNN, as did Donald Trump. Its editorial board wrote that she needs to drop the name-calling in the paper's opinion section. On the flip side, Representative Alan Grayson from Florida sent out two tweets supporting Ginsburg. He wrote he used to clerk for her back in the day, and in the second tweet he wrote, "In my opinion, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is our most supreme justice, and Donald Trump needs to STFU." Now, I'm not going to details about the acronym, but suffice it to say, it's not something you want to say in polite company. That's all for me today, Jim.
All right. Well, you can go Google that, as they say. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. And you may tweet us your comments and questions to @VOA_IE. That's our own Twitter stream. And you can find myself and G on Twitter @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia. China and Philippines eye talks after maritime claim ruling. U.S. challenges China's export duties on key raw materials at the WTO. Afghan obstacles front and center during U.S. Defense Secretary visit. Greens say they're skeptical about India's ambitions to rejuvenate the Ganges River. Reports say Japan Emperor Akihito planning to retire. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and at our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. China's heated denunciation of Tuesday's ruling by an international arbitration panel against its claim of sovereignty over most of the South China Sea continued on Wednesday, with the vice foreign minister warning against turning the vital waterway into a cradle of war. He also held out the right of China to declare an air defense identification zone over the South China Sea. The state-run People's Daily said China would take all necessary measures to protect its sovereignty and maritime rights. Beijing also issued a white paper accusing the Philippines of acting in bad faith in filing its complaint with the Permanent Court of Arbitration. China refused to take part in the proceeding and has rejected its finding. China's U.S. Ambassador Sui Tiankai said that at a think tank at the Centers for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington on Tuesday, the court acted without China's consent and exceeded its jurisdiction involving the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
The case was carefully masked, but it's beyond any doubt that the core issues are territory disputes, and territory issues are not subject to the UNCLOS. People may say the tribunal may decide its own jurisdiction, but they don't have a free hand. They have to take the decision in strict accordance with the provisions of the convention. Failure to recognize that is a matter of professional incompetence. This case was initiated not out of goodwill or good faith. It is a clear attempt to use legal instruments for political purposes. What is more disturbing is that the proceedings will probably do a great deal of damage to the efforts by the members of the international community to engage in negotiations and consultation for settlement of any possible disputes. This arbitration case will probably open the door of abusing arbitration procedures. It will certainly undermine or weaken the motivation of states to engage in negotiations and consultations for solving their disputes.
The Chinese diplomat said the ruling will only intensify conflict and even confrontation, although he insisted China prefers negotiation. A U.S. spokesman said Washington supports efforts to resolve territorial and maritime disputes peacefully and through such arbitration. The Philippines urged restraint and sobriety, but Asia Foundation analyst Steve Rood in Manila tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the reaction to the ruling ranges from cautious celebration to total jubilation.
There are many people who feel that this totally vindicates the Philippines' position and would be a very good boost as we move forward in the negotiations that must follow. Those in responsible positions, those who actually have to do the work, tend to be a little more cautious in their public statements, talking about the need to avoid jubilation, but also about how to confer with ASEAN neighbors who are affected in some way by the ruling.
China is blaming the Philippines for stirring up trouble in the dispute. The vice foreign minister said that it is the Philippines that has created and stirred up the trouble. Is this going to cause a problem in bilateral ties?
I don't think so. This is the sort of thing that we would expect from China, which, as you know, has utterly refused to have anything to do with the permanent Court of Arbitration's proceedings. But also, the Philippines is well aware that China would reject it, and the Philippines will be looking for more subtle signs of China's interest in bilateral negotiations, which is the new element on the Philippine side, the willingness to enter into bilateral negotiations now that the tribunal has ruled.
Stephen Rood says Philippine officials hope the sovereignty rhetoric will die down and talks can begin on joint management of resources. He says members of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, now hope for a more formal code of conduct covering the South China Sea. Ankit Panda, associate editor of the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat, says Chinese statements of outrage reflect what he calls a genuine perception of national humiliation.
When the Chinese claim that the United States is egging this on, that might not be what's happening in reality, but it is a deeply held perception, I think, in China. And I don't think it's just rhetoric. The threats that, you know, violence might be around the corner, there might be actual conflict, that might be a little bit more strategically calculated. So there is a possibility that China and the Philippines will look to engage in bilateral negotiations, which is what China has preferred all along. There is an interesting discussion to be had, though, about the nature of this verdict. In some ways, it was more in favor of the Philippines than many analysts, including myself, had predicted. The court almost ruled in the Philippines' favor on all questions, with the exception of a couple features in the Spratly Islands. That actually makes things a little bit complicated because politically, Rodrigo Duterte will be limited in his ability to concede features to China in any sort of bilateral arrangement for joint development or the joint exploitation of fishing resources within the exclusive economic zone. Because once you have a ruling like this, where an international court essentially tells the Philippines what maritime entitlements are rightfully its under international law, it'd be very difficult politically for the Duterte government to make any real concessions.
Ankit Panda says not all the claims in the South China Sea by China's neighbors are similar to that of the Philippines. He says the lingering dispute between Beijing and Vietnam over the Paracel Islands, for instance, will be far more complicated to resolve. Britain has a new prime minister. Theresa May ceremonially accepted an invitation from the Queen to form a new government after the ceremonial and political resignation of David Cameron. Cameron made his final appearance in the House of Commons, where he received a standing ovation for his performance after 6 years in the job. The normally raucous prime minister's questions turned into a friendly session Wednesday when Cameron was praised for helping to reduce unemployment, fund the National Health Service, and improve educational opportunities.
I will miss the roar of the crowd. I will miss the barbs from the opposition. But I will be willing you on. And when I say willing you on, I don't just mean willing on the new prime minister at this dispatch box, or indeed just willing on the front bench defending the manifesto that I helped to put together. But I mean willing all of you on, because people come here with huge passion for the issues they care about. They come here with great love for the constituencies that they represent.
Cameron also gave all but a guarantee to European Union citizens living in Britain that they would not be forced to leave the country when Britain leaves the bloc. He said the government is working hard to do what we want, which is to give a guarantee to EU citizens that they will have their rights respected. Cameron resigned after Britain's narrow vote in the referendum of June 23rd to leave the European Union. He had backed the Remain in the bloc campaign. Theresa May, the Home Secretary in the current cabinet, will take over as Prime Minister. May is expected to unveil the new cabinet lineup, including a minister in charge of implementing Brexit. NASA's deep space probe Juno has sent back its first image of the planet Jupiter since it arrived at the interstellar gas giant. The U.S. Space Agency released a picture Tuesday showing Jupiter surrounded by three of its four largest moons, Io, Europa, and Ganymede. Juno entered orbit around Jupiter last week after a five-year 2.8 billion kilometer journey. Ground controllers deliberately kept the probe's camera, dubbed JunoCam, and other instruments shut down as a precaution as Juno passed through Jupiter's extreme radiation environment. The probe will spend the next 20 months studying the fifth and biggest, the planet in our solar system, to help scientists determine the foundations of our solar system and to search for signs of a solid surface beneath its cloud-covered atmosphere. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, while we're enjoying all those fresh pictures of Jupiter, Captain Kirk, Commander Spock, Dr. McCoy, and the rest of the crew of the Starship Enterprise are returning to the big screen in Star Trek Beyond, the third installment of the rebooted Star Trek movie series. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that the crew has to overcome a new enemy after their ship is destroyed and they're marooned on a strange planet.
My dad joined Starfleet because he believed in it. I joined on a dare.
You joined to see if you could live up to him. You spent all this time trying to be your father. Now you're wondering just what it means to be you.
Chris Pine and Carl Urban return as Captain Kirk and Dr. McCoy for Star Trek Beyond. The crew of the Enterprise, including Zachary Quinto as First Officer Spock, Simon Pegg as Chief Engineer Montgomery Scott, and Zoe Saldana as Communications Officer Lieutenant Uhura, is halfway through its five-year mission when the ship is attacked by an alien life form. The Enterprise crew is marooned on an unknown planet with no apparent means of rescue. That planet is also the home of Krall, a ruthless military commander played by Idris Elba. The movie is directed by Justin Lin, known for his work on the Fast and the Furious franchise. J.J. Abrams directed the first two Star Trek films in the rebooted series, but Lin was added to the process late, after J.J. was confirmed as producer only so he could direct Star Wars: The Force Awakens. But Chris Pine says that Justin Lin was able to get the most out of the cast.
It's different, Justin, so far as we're used to J.J. because he's directed the last two, and but Justin came in really kind of near the end of the process of getting the film together, and he became a great general under whom we all kind of coalesced and fit in really easily.
Lin would shoot during the day and edit the dailies at night in order to get the film done. But he says the long hours paid off.
You know, I think when you're doing the right things with the right group of people, and it, it's going to be hard, but it's something that you do willingly, and you do it because you want to do it.
Simon Pegg co-wrote the script with Doug Jung after original writer Roberto Orsi was changed from director to producer. Pegg says that having Jung as a co-writer helped him balance the script.
Well, the thing is that because I was writing every character, it didn't matter who I gave the lines to, you know. It was enormous fun, you know, and I didn't want to overput myself in it. So I would ask Doug, my co-writer, is it okay if Scotty's in this bit? And he'd say yes or no.
Idris Elba says that playing Krall, a lizard-like villain previously unseen in the Star Trek universe, was a great thrill.
I mean, I think there's a long legacy of really big villains in Star Trek movies, and like, you know, the opportunity for me to do that was just like, why not, you know? Actually, Benedict Cumberbatch's villain in Into the Darkness was so good. I was like, I mean, I know I want to get a part of that.
This film also features the revelation that helmsman Hiroku Sulu is gay. Co-writer Doug Jung plays Sulu's husband. John Cho says he wanted it to send a message to Asian boys struggling with their sexuality.
That was my Valentine. That was my tip of the hat to all the Asian boys that I've known who are gay growing up, who felt uncomfortable being with other Asian men because of the cultural backlash.
Star Trek Beyond also features Anton Yelchin as Pavel Chekhov, his final film before his accidental death on June 19th. Star Trek Beyond opens in U.S. theaters July 22nd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
It's time for Scotty to beam all of us up from International Edition, but we will rematerialize at voanews.com anytime that you like. Visit us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Educating girls is one of the most powerful instruments for reducing poverty and inequality and can lay the foundation for sustained economic growth. For every year of education a girl attains, her future earning potential goes up by 10%. And because she is likely to share up to 90% of her earnings with her family and her community, everyone around her will benefit. Simply put, said USAID Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, Susan Markham, when women are educated, they are a powerful force for change. Nonetheless, some 62 million who should be attending school are not. Too often, they are marginalized and devalued, assigned to do menial chores, fetch water, and watch over other children, while boys are expected to attend school, become breadwinners, and represent the family in public gatherings and forums, said Senior Coordinator Markham. To change this dynamic, we must focus on promoting gender equality and women's empowerment worldwide, while also engaging men and boys. But women's empowerment is critical to our core mission of ending extreme poverty and promoting resilient, democratic societies with healthy, well-educated citizens. These are some of the reasons why U.S. foreign policy prioritizes gender equality and the advancement of women and girls. We help girls access primary education, including those living in crisis or conflict-affected areas. Our reading programs ensure that girls have literacy skills that are foundational for future learning and success. We also support workforce development programs, which will help girls gain better jobs. From birth to adulthood, girls face innumerable obstacles that boys do not. We document and address these problems through a holistic approach, which encompasses the interconnected events that resonate across a girl's life from birth to adulthood, and work to change the perception of girls' value at the individual, community, and institutional levels. And finally, through programs like Let Girls Learn, USAID works across sectors to address the root causes that keep adolescent girls out of school and limit their ability to make life decisions. USAID envisions a world, said Senior Coordinator Markham, where females and males are equally able to access quality education and health care, accumulate and control their own economic assets and resources, exercise their own voice, and live free from intimidation, harassment, and discrimination. Valued as leaders, innovators, peace builders, and breadwinners in their communities and societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.